Welcome to the Movie Vault. I'm Ben.
And I'm Zach.
And today, we have a very special guest with us, driving all the way over from Pickerington, Ohio, Ian Anderson.
Good morning.
How are you doing this morning, Ian?
I'm doing great, actually. Happy to be here on the podcast. I don't know that I've pushed to be on this podcast quite like Ethan Lanau has, but I'm excited to be on it for sure.
Once we had Ethan on, we were like, oh, I guess we have to have Ian on too. So hopefully you can bask in this moment, and but maybe we'll have you on again one day.
If this goes well.
That's right. If you want to have me back on.
It's like an interview if you want to think about it like that. That's no, right. but today we are reviewing a very colorful movie, and I apologize we couldn't provide the accommodations like the Space Hotel in this movie. But we are reviewing Luc Besson's The Fifth Element. Mm. Not to be confused with The Sixth Sense, which came out a couple years later.
Or The Fifth Wave, which came out many years later.
And Zach started watching mistakenly.
Thank goodness it was this film that we were going to review.
Did you start watching it and you were like,
this is horrible, Ian. Yeah.
Why the heck does Ian want to do this movie?
I mean, we've had that happen before where people are like, oh yeah, I want to do this movie. And we're like, I don't know what we can say about this movie that would be interesting.
To be honest, that's why we switched from them picking the movie to them. Yeah. But we trusted Ian. We thought his taste would be good. But so feel honored about that at least. And we also let Ethan pick, and they were both good picks.
Yeah, so The Fifth Element is a movie that was released in 1997. Again, directed by Luc Besson, who had some pizzazz in the U.S. following the release of Leon the Professional, which I hadn't made the connection, but like I've definitely watched that movie. And it's interesting because this movie was kind of a turn in style and like everything from The Professional.
Have you seen Leon?
Yes, I have. Oh. I have seen it.
How would you say it's different?
This movie just gets a lot more colorful and comedic than Leon does, where that movie felt like more like it's about a hitman, and it's about a relationship with him and like this young girl. And it is a good movie, but it's just nothing like this movie. There's a film movement that's tied to this movie and Luc Besson in general called Cinéma du Look, which I think just means like the look of the movie. This very like stylistic movies based on like isolated characters. So in that sense, like Leon the Professional does fit within that mold because it's about like this really isolated guy and him like opening up, I guess, by being a hitman. But this movie also with Bruce Willis as the main character stars a guy who's kind of isolated and has to like overcome some of those things in order to save the world ultimately at the end.
Come out of retirement.
Right.
I love that cliche. Right. It's my favorite cliche.
The budget was $90 million. It made $263 million, so it was a very successful movie commercially. And being that it was, I think, technically a French movie. I mean, it had to have done pretty well for, although it, you know, it was released in English. It was like produced by a French guy, but like it wasn't like people were going in and watching it with subtitles on.
No, it was just the director was French. It didn't feel French at all.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it probably doesn't count as reviewing a French art film.
No, we have done that though.
Actually, we'll count it.
No, we will count it. Yeah, we'll just toss it in with the.
Well, Les Samurai?
Les Samurai and Eyes Without a face. Yeah. Yeah, so the plot of the movie. Actually, Ian, could you briefly explain the plot of this movie? Because I feel like you could do a much better job explaining it than I could.
Okay, all right. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, it opens up in, quite a long time ago. I won't say ancient Egypt, I guess 1920s Egypt, and you're with some people doing, you know, some archaeological discoveries, and I think the young actor Luke Perry was a heartthrob back in the 90s.
Oh, so, he was.
Yeah, so there's a little, you know, little eye candy for the ladies there.
That's how you get them hooked in at the beginning.
Right, huh? Exactly.
Attention grabber.
And so, yeah, so it opens up with this discovery is being made by these hieroglyphics, and then all of a sudden these aliens show up, and they come to collect these elements that are in this chamber behind these hieroglyphics. And so it starts with a foreshadowing of time to come where this great evil is going to return. And these elements were the only thing that could defend Earth and mankind against this great evil. And then it immediately transitions, which one of the things I love about this movie is it's like, it's got like 100 fun segues.
Yeah.
And it segues to the exact year that evil is going to return. And it's, you know, way off in the future. And, totally different vibe. Mm-hmm. Bruce Willis is this washed up fighter pilot that's now a taxi cab driver, and he gets looped. Well, I don't want to unpack in too much detail, but he gets pulled into the story of defending mankind against this great evil. As the fifth element, literally. Falls into his cab.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Yeah. And yeah. I keep doing that. What one thing we do here on the Movie Vault is we say things and then we immediately talk about, like, make analysis of what we said. Mm-hmm. But no, that was very well described. I guess we don't usually do this, but I'll just say from this point on, it's okay to talk about spoilers. This movie came out in 1997, so if you haven't seen it yet, go watch it. I watched it on Hulu. So
it's on Hulu.
Yeah, you've got. I signed up for like the student version. You bought it.
Yeah, I didn't even look.
Well, it's a good movie.
Yeah, it was worth.
Yeah, it's worth it. Yeah. Worth having. Yeah. So Corbin Dallas is the main character, and the fifth element is a person named is it Lilu?
Lilu.
Lilu.
Yeah. You know, she's got a much longer name. I haven't memorized it, so we'll stick with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, because she speaks in the ancient tongue, which nobody else knows. The divine
language.
And so there's elements of, like, lots of different movies here. Like, the way that New York City is set up with the cars flying reminds me of Blade Runner. The way that she, like, downloads all the information and learns martial arts reminds me of The Matrix, which I guess hadn't even come out yet, so maybe it was a slight influence on The Matrix, if anything. So lots of different sci-fi elements. But I think that the difference between this movie and a lot of sci-fi movies is its willingness to get kind of wacky and not take itself too seriously and still develop, like, interesting backstories and characters. It's a world that I was thinking about it and I was like, I wouldn't mind living in this world or, like, seeing this world more. Actually, living in it might not be that pleasant.
Yeah, I was about to really hardly disagree with you.
But revisiting, because sci-fi is one of those genres that tends to, you know, get a lot of, you know, you make sequels and you build out the world. And that's not always beneficial, but this movie, you're like, oh, if there was, like, one or two movies set in this world, it'd be interesting.
The Seventh Element.
That's right.
We
the plot line might become a bit forced at a certain point.
Yeah. We found another one.
Yeah, exactly. There's another great evil coming.
The third one's coming.
It comes in threes.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was the best part of the film was honestly just the wackiness of it.
Yeah.
It was awesome. One of my favorite parts of the film was at the beginning when there's like an ad for something and then the ad pulls out a gun and tries to rob him right at his own place. I was like, this is amazing. I mean, it's trying to tell of the future, obviously, consumerism, stuff like that. And it's also, like, trying to give a joke and propel the plot a little forward while giving an introduction to Bruce Willis's character. So, yeah, I thought there were moments like that throughout the film. And it was surprising how clever they were to me.
Yeah.
Just because you don't see that in many sci-fi films. A lot of times, a serious sci-fi film like this, because this I do consider serious, they don't have these cool, wacky elements like that.
Yeah, the plot line is actually very serious. There's a lot of heavy elements to it, but mm-hmm. there's so much comedy interwoven and kind of style. It's I would describe it as stylistically kind of bubblegummy.
Yeah, and so that makes sense.
It's if it was just stylistically like that, it would be very kind of campy. and cheap. And if it was just dealing with the plot lines that it deals with, it could be a pretty heavy movie. But with the two combined, there's like this very pleasant tension, I feel like, throughout the movie.
So there's a plethora of villains in this movie, one of them being the great evil itself, which they start by trying to, like, they know it's this like orb of like flame and blackness that's just like coming towards Earth. So the president's first idea is to just shoot stuff at it, but that obviously it doesn't work. And they end up losing guys. So they have to figure something else out. But then there's also Jean-Baptiste Emmanuel Zorg, played by Gary Oldman.
Which is the best name ever.
Jean-Baptiste Emmanuel Zorg.
It's like a holy name and like a sci-fi name mixed together.
Yeah, he's a hilarious character. His like hairstyle and his you know, just everything about him. And he's an arms dealer, correct?
Among other things. His conglomerate company owns the cab company that Bruce Willis works for.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Yeah.
There, lots of connections. And he's also after the stones.
Yes.
So, exactly. I'm not sure why.
Well, wasn't the great evil kind of using him?
Yeah, exactly. The great evil wants the first four elements so that nothing can stop his destruction of life.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so
right.
he's working through Zorg to get the fourth element.
Interestingly and he like calls enough, him on a phone, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Interestingly enough, the great evil doesn't have a very good concept of the fifth element, though.
Yeah. I thought that was super interesting. Just like, he's not really doing anything to look for the fifth one necessarily. It's always the fourth one. Or the first four.
I guess in his mind, if you don't have the first four, then the fifth one doesn't matter. If you don't know about what the fifth element is. And then there's also these creatures called Mangalores who are used to... They're kind of like the stormtroopers of the movie. The brute force attacking forces that get shot up in droves.
Are those the goblin-looking ones?
Yeah.
Okay.
They can also shapeshift and look like... look like people.
So they are also going for the stones.
Yes.
So then you have them, you have the Zorg conglomerate, which are all under the great... What are those called again?
Mangalores, right?
The goblin-looking things. Are those under the great evil as well? I can't remember.
No, so they're working for Zorg, but then Zorg crosses them because they screw up and don't get the stones.
That's
and
right.
So they're trying to redeem themselves and get the stones. Meanwhile, Jean-Baptiste Emmanuel Zorg is, you know, as he says himself, if you want it done right, do it yourself.
Yeah.
And so he's going after the stones himself.
And Thanos took that line right after him, so, at the end of Age of Ultron.
Very similar characters there.
Yep.
And Bruce Willis is a, as Corbin Dallas, he's a cab driver, but we hear very early on that he was a decorated general in probably their version of the Air Force or the Space Force. But he's sort of this like disgruntled, something must have happened in the past and he doesn't really want any part of the military.
Do we have a Space Force?
We do have a Space Force.
Are they like official right now?
It is official. I don't know what they do, but I do know that it is a real branch of the military.
Wow. Yep. They've got their own flag and their emblem.
Yep.
Interesting.
Now, like, I feel like crazy. If I was going to go into any branch of the military, it'd probably be the Space Force because maybe I wouldn't have to do as much.
I'm just imagining you in an astronaut suit.
Well, you probably have to, if you want to be an astronaut, you usually have to go through the Air Force.
The Space Force will end up like Ender's Game. Have you ever read that book?
Nope.
Have you?
No, but it just like plugged into a VR headset.
Yeah, like simulations and stuff like that. Yeah, and then they like genetically breed a human to fight off an alien race. So.
Yeah. I need to... Yeah, that's on my list.
Yeah, it's great, but...
Is it similar at all to the fifth element?
I'm sorry, Ben. Influences?
No, I was asking like as a...
Is this tangent okay?
No, I wasn't trying to diss on your tangent. I was asking whether you see any influences from Ender's Game on...
No.
Okay.
Sorry.
We won't follow that trail.
Sorry, Orson Scott Card. That's the author. Yeah. I think... Maybe it would be good to go into the favorite parts of the film without, and then we'll kind of go into the rest of the plot with it. What would you say your favorite part of the film was, Ian?
Man, I think, I mean, so a little bit of background here. It came out in 97. I became a Christian in late 1998. I saw the movie probably in 99, 2000 for the first time. And so I think I really resonated with the, you know, obviously not, it's not a direct allegory by any stretch of the imagination, but I appreciated the messianic themes in the movie. And then I just loved the styling mm-hmm. that Luc Besson put into it. Not only the costuming, but the kind of the funky music that mm-hmm. goes along with
oh,
it.
Oh, that's and, true, yeah.
And sound effects. And there's something like, it's sci-fi like, but it's all, you know, growing up in the Seattle area during the grunge era, there's some kind of grungy 90s influence in a way. I know it sounds kind of funny because it's
so like polished in other areas, but yeah, I see that.
It's like the music and the sound effects are like very kind of raw and unpolished and grimy, I guess would be a way to describe it. So
there's a lot of like there's like contrast between a nicer area and then like a seedy underbelly of like this is or like we imagine New York City today. There's like nice parts and then there's like the not as nice parts.
So there's that's those are the things that like hooked me. And then from a nostalgic standpoint, I continue to enjoy watching it because there's like elements of
pun
elements of my adolescence that pop up, even down to there's all this futuristic stuff, but then you look at, you know, priest Vito Cornelius's house, he's still got a CRT monitor. And there's like this kind of like this relic technology that's going on at the same time.
Yeah.
Which is great. I mean, it also kind of works with, you know, the original Star Wars vibe where it's like in a galaxy far, far away from a time long, long ago.
Yeah.
To where it's like old, new technology.
Definitely.
So, anyways.
I felt Attack of the Clones specifically in this.
Yeah, I could see that.
I think the city in Attack of the Clones, was it Coruscant or something?
Yeah, Coruscant, yeah.
That I felt that in this city whenever I was there. I was like, where are the aliens going to come in and mind control these people?
And that like era of Star Wars was like much more colorful too, like this movie. Mm-hmm. And there's even the one guy even holds like, I don't think it's not like a lightsaber at all, but the DJ has this like thing.
Was that Chris Tucker?
Oh yeah. Ruby Ride.
He was the worst and best character in the film.
True. I can't see Chris Rock without hearing Ruby Ride in my head. I'm sorry. Or excuse me. Wait, did I say Chris Rock?
You did.
That'd be hilarious.
Chris Tucker.
I was like, wow, Chris Rock.
I apologize to both Chris Rock and Chris Tucker, who will probably. Neither of them will ever listen to this podcast.
Hey, but you never know, Ian.
Hey, we got listeners from all over the world.
Yep.
Maybe one day on a plane, Chris Tucker will be like, well.
Hey, what you listening to? Well, hey, my own podcast.
I don't know if he looks back on this role fondly or he cringes, but he did a great job either way.
Yeah,
he was incredible in some parts and extremely annoying in some parts. He was the Jar Jar Binks of this Star Wars.
Yeah, true.
But, oh my gosh, I agree with you, Ian. I think. Just the grunge. You said you felt a little grunge in it, and you know grunge better than me because that's your past. I mean, that's like you came from.
I have questions about that. So, what age were you during the grunge era? And you were in Seattle at that point.
Yeah. So now, don't give me too much credit because I was not in my late 20s going to the Phoenix Underground in the thick of it, but I was at least. In my late teens.
Right, that's still
and
a good time.
You know, I did go to, there's like this 18 and older club in Seattle called Deviate that had like slightly grungy, slightly like 90s dance Nouveau New Wave vibe going on.
Oh, interesting.
Which is kind of more along the line vibe of this movie.
Right, so. Yeah, that would fit more with this movie with the, yeah, the new, I could see New Wave and that sort of, yeah, that makes sense, I've been listening to Alice in Chains Unplugged.
He always tries to fit in some kind of music. Yeah.
And Nirvana, like their MTV Unplugged albums a lot lately.
Okay, yeah. By the way, that's why he asked you that question.
It's fine. Nirvana Unplugged was actually the first CD that I ever purchased.
Interesting. Wow. See, this is why I'm asking, Zach. It's relevant to the conversation.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying you enjoyed doing these. And then you can cut off my tangents.
Well, we gotta see who comes up with the better tangent.
I just need another thing. You're a bi thing. You're a bi-thingual.
Like, it's either music or movies.
Yeah, I gotta pick. I gotta get another one.
Yeah. I mean, you have other things.
Not really.
Medicine.
So do you.
That's true. You gotta get a thing that's different.
Yeah, with you, Ben.
Then I'll just become interested in it.
Yeah, otherwise.
Start to know more about it.
Otherwise, you'll be more famous than me in this podcast.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway.
People are like, who's that Zach guy?
Yeah, so I don't know. So, it's got that vibe, and then I can't remember when I first saw the movie. I think I really liked it, and then a year or two went by, and I was studying abroad in Denmark, and we took a class trip to Russia, and in the basement of the hotel in Moscow that we were staying in, there's a woman selling DVDs. I don't know if they're pirated or if they're just cheap. They were, you know, they were wrapped, and but they were encoded for that region. And I was like, I saw Fifth Element, so I bought Fifth Element from a woman in this Moscow basement.
See, that's a way cooler story.
That's
than
the coolest story I've ever heard.
Along with Matrix and The Patriot, and then there's a fourth movie. I can't remember what the fourth movie was.
That might be the coolest story that we've ever heard on the Movie Vault.
Yeah, for getting a digital or physical media. Oh my gosh.
So my laptop at the time, I changed the encoding so that I could watch my Russian DVDs. So I could only ever watch these four DVDs on that laptop.
That just like technology was so different even 20 years ago. Now you would never even like think about buying physical media. Well, okay, I bought two vinyl records in London, but
you bought Inland Empire, best decision you ever made.
That's true. Mm-hmm. But I could just buy it on Amazon. It ships in like 2 days.
But still,
so it's just way different than it used to be.
Yeah. But so did you only watch those four movies for a time?
I mean, you know, unless I was like going to the theaters or going over to friend's house. But if I was like watching a DVD at home, it was like, had to be one of those four movies.
See, that makes so much sense why this movie would have a lot of nostalgia for you.
And another cool thing, too, about having Russian DVDs is that in Russia, the film culture is heavy on dubbing. Mm. And so I could, I could watch them in English, thankfully. But it was either that or you watch it in Russian with or without English subtitles. And they have this whole culture of finding dub artists that have very similar voice qualities and styles to the actors. And so I must say that the Russian dub artist for Gary Oldman, because I did watch it one time in Russian with English subtitles, and he did a fantastic job as Zorg.
You watch it so many times, you're like, I need something a little bit different here.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's watch it in Russian. No,
The Matrix in Russian, I'd highly recommend. Creepy.
If we ever review The Matrix, we need to remember to review the Russian with English subtitles version.
People have seen the regular one enough.
There's enough podcasts on The Matrix. Yeah.
We'll just say Russian Matrix review. Yeah. No, that's great.
I wish I still had those, but I have neither that laptop nor the DVDs. But yeah. I'm sure you can find it online.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pirated.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting that the whole basis of this storyline is that this event happens with like a triple eclipse, and we just came off the heels of an eclipse
yesterday.
Yeah.
Do you all get to watch it?
No, I didn't.
You didn't get to watch it?
I purposely didn't. I was doing work.
You would be that guy.
What do you mean?
You just sometimes you're just a wet blanket.
That's not what
a
wet blanket.
Total eclipse of a type with a near moon that happens once every 357 years passes over Columbus, Ohio.
And like it's
is right, it 357?
Well,
just for I forget all the factors. Like the moon was closer, and there's solar activity going on. There may be a little hype in that. I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah, they do like to hype.
I thought it was 44. I thought I at least see another one.
You were down here, like closer to campus, you wouldn't have been able to see it totality. You had to be further north. Did you just watch like?
I went up to the roof of the building that my office is in,
and
so which was a little surreal because it was like a bunch of us from the office went up there with their eclipse glasses, and we go up there, and it's in a building with condos, and so we're up there with like, you know, retired boomers listening to yacht rock and drinking, and then there's like a couple of people, young professionals come up, and this guy is in his he's in his dress shirt with like board shorts and flip flops, and he's in the middle of a meeting, and he's got it on mute, and he's checking out the and then we all just kind of go back to our life, but.
Wow. Yeah, that was my experience too, because at Otterbein, they had a eclipse viewing party at the stadium, and I kid you not, this was the biggest event I had ever seen on Otterbein's campus. So all the events that they've tried to do, and I know COVID happened and all of that, so there was a while that they actively didn't want people to get together, but like everyone came out for this. And then it was funny because there's like, you know, look around at everyone that I've ever seen on campuses here, and then like 2 minutes after, everyone's like, okay, we're done. And everyone leaves. And I'm like, there'll probably never be a gathering that big for like until the next eclipse here at Otterbein, because there's not really that many things that bring everyone together.
Class of 2068.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
You anyway, you were saying with the triple
eclipse. I mean, that was pretty much it. Just that I wrote that down on my notes as something notable, just that we watched it. It's just like perfect timing for a movie like this.
Yeah, right.
I thought it was awesome that right when he wakes up, he just starts smoking, and then just some of the wordplay in this film was fun too. With what's her name, Lilu. Yeah. I'm thinking of Elio, which is a new Pixar movie coming out. But like, I just love the way that she has to kind of develop the language, English language. By the end, she understands more. But like, she starts out by like big bada boom, like it's the when she first
big bada boom.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like, me, big bada boom.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then she like goes into the airport or whatever, and she's like, multi-pass.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah. He knows it's a multi-pass.
Yeah. She knows it's a multi-pass. We're newlyweds.
So I love those kinds of things. And then, like, even just some of the Easter eggs in this film, like the futuristic McDonald's and stuff, that was awesome. Just like.
And then, like, they get it. It's like. And then he crashes by, it spills, and then they end up crashing into like a semi truck plane thing that's McDonald's, and they have the burgers. And you're like, oh, McDonald's, a good product placement there. That was memorable.
Yeah, it's like, have you guys ever seen Demolition Man?
No.
Okay, well, in that one, the only surviving food product is Taco Bell. And so there's like a little throwback. I can't remember. Demolition Man may have been 97 as well, so it's kind of
a big era.
Which came first, the chicken or the egg? But
a big era for fast food and movies.
Yeah,
I had an interesting question that maybe this will fall flat, maybe not. So she's perfect, right? That's what they say. She says that she is mankind's greatest possession, so she is perfect. I was really struggling to figure out how she is perfect. Like, how does that? What is that compared to? Obviously. There's a philosophy behind what perfect is, but I'm saying, like, what did they mean by perfect in this film, like, at all? I didn't know, like, I was so confused by that element of this film, also the pun in that sentence.
Yeah. Well, so, we find out early on, before she's revealed, so at first, you know, when they quote-unquote bring her into the nuclear lab, it's just this gauntlet-like glove holding onto a control that they pulled from this wreck site, and they put it in there and they reassemble, and you can tell that it's a humanoid body, and then the nuclear lab scientist says, you know, I can't remember the exact line, but like, you know, we have like 13 mammal groups in our DNA, and this has 2,668,000 mammal groups, so it's kind of the first view of her perfection is quote-unquote biologically perfect.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the screen rolls back and it's revealed to be this beautiful woman. So then, of course, it's just a bunch of dudes, and they think that she's
they're like, I need to take a perfect. Few pictures.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The military guy's like, yeah, for the archives.
Yeah. I was like, all right, here we go.
Yeah, and that's when the seedy vibe kicks in.
Yeah.
You're like, all like, right, these are the good guys, quote unquote. Yeah.
This scene would be great in Russian. But yeah, I mean, just it was like they say that like our DNA was double stranded, hers was like quadruple stranded, so it was like double the amount of DNA or something like that.
Yeah. But then the interesting thing is that later on, she's not an anti-hero by any stretch of imagination, but the tension is that she's flawed.
Yeah.
And you come to find out that she's not as strong as she appears.
Yeah.
Yeah. The priest makes a comment to Corbin Dallas.
Yeah.
And he says she's more fragile than she sees or she seems, or more fragile than she knows, something like that. And that kind of stuck out to me as you know, she's like handling all these Mangalores, but maybe there's some aspect of she doesn't understand where she needs help, which is where Corbin comes in ultimately.
Yeah, it's like that she needs your love, is what he said.
Yeah. And then at the end of the movie, she is struggling to like reason as to why she needs to save humanity, which is maybe a good question. I mean, she's always like, she's, some people might view her as more of a tool than an actual like human. I don't know what she's considered, if she's even considered human, but they see her as like the person, the tool, the fifth element to save the world, and not necessarily as somebody who has feelings or thoughts. Or I don't think Corbin ever views her that way, but, or maybe he does slightly, but I, like, as the movie progresses, I think he starts to view her more as an actual person.
Well, he started out as a tool because he kissed her right when he first met her.
That's a good point. That's why I was, yeah.
Ectogamut. What does that mean?
Only with my permission. Only with my,
that's what I thought.
Like, I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, that was great. Some of the, I mean, the men in this film are not role models, I'll tell you that.
No.
It's more an accurate representation.
Maybe so.
Yeah, there's definitely some realism in the film. It, you know, intermixed with all of its craziness. But I appreciated the fact that she was portrayed as this sort of biologic perfection, that the greatest possession of mankind. And I thought that was, you know, once again, I don't, there's certainly no, you know, Lilu is Jesus, Jesus is Lilu.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case. But one thing that kind of brings to the forefront is that, you know, if you think about it, like within the prophetic text in the Bible, the Messiah is talked about, and I'm treading on thin ice to a certain degree here because I'm, you know, I don't come from a Jewish background. I didn't live 2,000 years ago, but my understanding is that, you know, and certainly from reading the Bible, that the view of the Messiah was that he was going to be this great political savior for the state of Israel, and God's chosen people. And so he was viewed as, when he came, that he was going to be kind of this entity, this almost kind of detached, higher, you know, higher than a normal human being, unrelatable individual. And yet, you know, from a Christian perspective, for those who believe that Jesus Christ of Nazareth is the Messiah, what you find is a person that's actually very relatable and close and vulnerable.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, when he goes to, when he waits and then comes to raise Lazarus from the dead, he sees people weeping over his friend Lazarus, and he begins to weep himself. And so there's this, kind of breaking of the mold. And so that's, I think there is an analogy in the case of this movie to where, the fifth element is this, you know, imperceivable perfection. And then when you meet the fifth element, it's this kind of slightly built, beautiful woman who is tough and remarkable, but is also vulnerable and able to get hurt and is in need of love. Mm-hmm. When you don't think that she's in need of anything, and she's there just to deliver on her prophetic promises.
Yeah. And obviously there are discrepancies between the two as well.
Of course.
Yeah. We're the ones who need love in the biblical sense.
Exactly.
And the other thing is the Jews that didn't believe in Jesus in the Bible, it was because of their hearts, not because, I mean, their expectations were not the correct expectations of the Messiah, but ultimately it was their hearts that rejected him rather than facts or logic. But yeah, I think that element, I'm going to keep doing that pun, is definitely seen in this film. I actually thought about it, and it even reminded me of Dune a little bit, where you see Paul, the main character, kind of who is this messiah for these, I forget the sand people name.
There's all these different,
the sand people, Zendaya's.
I forget the quote.
Just, I don't know.
I haven't seen part two yet either. So
anyway, so I mean, and that reminded me of, you know, biblical messiahism. I mean, all of it.
And The Matrix.
We talked about
that. Yeah, well, yeah.
There's something with sci-fi movies and messianic characters.
We talked about this on the Goonies episode. Just kind of like, there is this biblical foundation that gives the story of redemption that many movies have followed since, right? And this is a story of redemption, right? It's a story of a guy who has 1 point left on his license, absolutely, who is really at the end of... I don't know what the phrase is.
Bad relationship with his mother.
I mean, that's his mother's fault, I'm guessing.
I just wanted to bring up that bit because it was hilarious. Especially at the end when she called the president.
Yeah. She's like, that's not the president. He's stupid. You don't sound stupid.
She's an interesting shtick throughout the movie, for sure.
Yeah. So, and again, it's just like you see all these elements, pun, going through all these sci-fi, it's not just sci-fi films. It's, I mean, the redemption arc is in all these. And that's what makes that's what draws people to stories is redemption, because we all feel that need for redemption inside of us. And that draws us to watch stories that where characters who are flawed are redeemed. You know, a lot of times the messages in films are bad where they can redeem themselves, where we know we need redempted of. Rather, we need to be used than to use ourselves. So, anywho, yeah, I think that's like the core of this film. That's what I felt interested me the most, was that prophetic element, kind of like what you said. And it's also interesting, like, what is she, you know, what is she actually? Because the fifth element, we know these four elements, we're familiar with water, earth, air, and fire, right? But what is physically, what is this fifth element? And I didn't know if, like, she is an actual fifth element, like, that the physical world has not seen, or if it's just like she's a creature that will represent this fifth element per se and isn't like the other four elements. I didn't know kind of what direction they were going with that.
Well, and then you have to ask yourself the question at the end. She is the fifth element, or is she the fifth element? Is the fifth element actually
love?
And the fifth element is actually made up of perfection joined with this really broken segment of humanity that needed redemption. And so the fifth element is not just her, but it's her and Corbin, and it's this union of the two, and the union of perfection and broken humanity.
Union is a perfect word for that.
Interesting. Because if you think about it, if they just put her in the middle, nothing happened. It didn't work.
No.
And it was at their union that the fifth element was released and the evil was stopped.
And the priest knew that.
Yeah.
I'm just curious why he didn't say that before.
Kiss her, Corbin.
It was a very premature kiss.
Yeah. He didn't always seem like the brightest bulb, the priest.
No.
I mean, somewhere along the line of training these priests, you know, they're just like, okay, you're
going to be the period of the judges,
You're going to be the next priest.
Well, I guess that's before
priest. Because even the guy below him who was training was like kind of a dunce.
Yeah. Somehow 300 years along the line. Although you could even argue that back when we saw them in 1920s Egypt, he was getting ready to poison them. The priest was. Mm-hmm. So there's
priests are definitely not perfect in this movie.
Yeah.
They were Eli's sons.
Exactly.
Well, it's interesting that you pulled all that out, because now it kind of makes sense and comes together. Like, but I wouldn't have necessarily thought about it that way, at least on the first viewing. But yeah, especially that union.
You have to think about it in Russian to understand.
The movie is like way more interesting. If they would have just made it a movie where it's just like, okay, we got her and she got to the end and oh, she defeated, like we've seen 100 movies, maybe more, that are like have that sort of just like narrative that just pushes forward and then it has a conclusion. You have a problem and the solution and then there's some other problems and then you get the final solution, which it is to some degree, but it just adds a little bit more flair to the story that they have them both together. Obviously, like the idea of a love being like the solution to problems is also in a lot of movies, but
yeah,
like that's because it's a universally relatable idea, I think, to some mostly degree. Not that it actually is the solution to every problem or in like actual
all you
life
need is love, love.
But I mean it is in the biblical sense too, because the love that Jesus gives us grants us like hope in life. So if we think about it that way, love is the answer. It's just the context of what the context of what you how you say love is the answer is very important, because it could be right or wrong depending on what you mean.
There
by
is
it.
I mean when people say love, many people don't understand what they're actually saying.
No, they're just using like a blanket term.
And including myself, I do that many times. You know, I love these pancakes.
I love them deeply.
Yeah. Agape. Love for these pancakes. These pancakes. I
would willingly sacrifice of myself these pancakes.
Yeah. And that's an interesting element of this film. Like, just the fact that it's the union between the perfect and the imperfect. Just like the bridegroom in the church.
It's even interesting that Ruby Rod ends up getting swept up into the story of redemption, and at the end he's one of the people activating the four elements, because he's, you know, talk about it, like representation of just like kind of shallow culture.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's interesting because he, you know, he's like the biggest celebrity figure in the entire show, and then as they're flying away, escaping from Flossed in Paradise, he signs off on a show, and he's like, "That's the best show that I've ever made." It's like there's meaning has been added to his has been forced upon him, and there's like even a little redemption on Ruby Rod. It's like he was like the most shallow character, but then he gets swept up in the story of redemption and he realizes, wow, this is actually good. It's not it's not just the, you know, X-rated sound bits and flirtation and you know, all the rest of it that sell his
spontaneity
show. Spontaneity. Yeah. Sponsorships from Gemini Croquette.
Yeah. Which is awesome.
Which I did actually unfortunately I forgot. I was gonna see if I could find modern day croquettes in the freezer section of Kroger and bring some over so we could eat the Easter in the but I ran out of time.
That's okay.
I think it's probably too obscure.
It's all right.
Yeah, that would have been interesting if you could find
croquettes. Yeah, I did when I was looking online though. Cult classic followers of this movie have posted recipes for Gemini croquettes, so
naturally.
But I don't have nearly that much forethought or ability at this hour.
So I wanted to dive a little bit into Luc Besson. Notably, I guess right off the bat, reading through his Wikipedia, I have to say that maybe the view of women that men have in this movie is a little bit of a reflection on Luc Besson as an actual person, because he's been married 4 times and also has some allegations against him, which I guess that were never substantiated, but still, like, it's significant that if somebody has allegations against them to the nature that he does. So I mean that's notable in the sense that, like, you can see how, like, maybe, like, his view of women came out in this
he
in
was
this
looking
movie
for
how
his
it might
fifth
be
element,
problematic.
Never found
unfortunately
her.
In filmmaking in general, that is commonplace. Hopefully that will continue to become less so over time. Yeah. But we know with how flawed people are, unfortunately, probably stuff like that will still happen. Even people who are considered geniuses are going to sometimes be able to get away with more, sadly, because of that.
Yeah.
Which is what we saw in 8.5.
Yeah.
With Fellini. Guido. And his view of directors. Mm-hmm. But although that is bad, aside from that, he has made several notable movies. He, like I said, he was influential in the cinema de look movement, and then eventually broke through in the U.S. with The Professional in 1994. He's been still making movies. I think the most notable movie he's made in recent times that I've heard of is Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. Like, I remember, I never watched the movie, but I remember it had some buzz when it came out.
He made Taken?
Taken,
yeah, he did the Taken series.
Whoa. Oh, he did the Taken series, yeah,
I
too.
I never realized that.
So, yep. So he has definitely continued to have, like, a career in the U.S. that people talk about, but maybe...
And back in 1990, he did La Femme Nikita, which I've never seen, but back in the 90s, that was like a buzzword.
Yeah, like a...
Like, for any, you know, before Kill Bill came out, it was like any, you know... kind of tough killer
femme fatale
gal. Femme fatale was, you know, La Femme Nikita was referenced.
Interesting. And he actually married the star of this movie, Milo Jovovich.
Yeah.
Or if that's how you pronounce your last name.
Yeah, Milo Jovovich.
They were married for 2 years, so a little short-lived.
And while they were married, he also cast her as Joan of Arc in The Messenger.
Yeah.
So... And the interesting thing is, I think he, at the start of filming or shortly before, he was still married to the actress that played the diva Pablo Laguna, if I'm not mistaken. So there's
interesting
some extra spice there.
Wow, lots of drama.
He was
in the
married
cast.
To the diva, and then he married the Fifth Element.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I wonder if making of this movie had any say in that. I don't know.
Who knows?
So a little bit about cinema de look. It's described as like favoring style over substance and spectacle over narrative, which I wouldn't say this movie lacks substance by any means. But I think what they're saying is that if they're going to have to pick between the two, they're going to pick style, which I can appreciate.
I hate when you have to pick, though. Just
yeah.
Do both.
Yeah. You shouldn't have to pick. But I do think that there are movies I can think of that like... In
Ready
terms
Player
of
One.
Substance, they're not like the greatest, but stylistically they're so interesting that it kind of creates its own version of substance.
1917.
Yeah, 1917 would be one. I'm trying to think of a good example. Actually, another French movie. Now I'm forgetting what it's called, but it's the one where the guy drives in the limousine and does random stuff. And that movie, I wouldn't say has like a ton of substance to it, but it's very interesting stylistically. And there's some like horror movies and stuff that are kind of like that too. Where,
any Cronenberg film?
Yeah, lots of Cronenberg films are like that. I mean, he tries to get really interesting substance-wise, but it's really more about like, wow, this head exploded, you know?
Wow, he's a fly.
Yeah. Even Brandon Cronenberg, his son, his movies are like very, based in...
Cronenberg-y?
Yeah, Cronenbergian, maybe to a new level. Yeah. So... I can appreciate that take on filmmaking. He's considered to be a pretty influential French filmmaker, but probably doesn't have like the name that like Truffaut and Godard have. In terms of his overall impact, I don't think he's made as many influential movies as they did. But he also worked in a completely different style. So, any other thoughts on Luc Besson?
Man, yeah, I don't know. I think. Yeah, I just think the style is great. I've seen Valerian, was it in the City of a Thousand Planets? Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was good. I enjoyed it, but it was not a Fifth Element.
Right.
But I still thought the style was quite good in that movie. It was very visually appealing. I think in both films, I found myself captivated by the visuals and thinking on them. Long afterwards, and I appreciate that because it's there's special effects in both films, but I appreciate more when a sci-fi spends the license you get from setting a movie in a sci-fi setting, spends it on art and style, mm-hmm. and less on technical, as a technical showcase.
Yeah, less hyperdrives, more orange wife beaters.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, yeah, so it's just, yeah, so I really appreciate that about him. I guess that maybe this inspires me to look at some more, what is it, Film de Luc?
Yeah.
Cinema de Luc.
Yeah, that would be an interesting.
Cinema de Luc.
I'd never heard of it. Like,
so how is de Luc spelled?
It's spelled...
D-U, then L-O-O-K?
Yeah, there's... Oh, okay. And obviously cinema is spelled with
the look. Of the look.
Yeah, cinema of the look.
That would be cool if it was like De and then his last name. Like,
is he the founder of it? Is it
De-Luc Buisson?
L-U-C?
It sounds cool, but it's like, yeah, very like cinema of the look. So that it's style over substance, essentially.
Yeah.
It's cool when we say it. We like to say things in a way that makes us sound smart.
Yeah, like know about all these film errors, but really it's just like you're spouting off buzzwords.
Yeah, yeah. We could tell people like it's cinema for the look, or we could say cinema de look and then have to explain it for like 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, what kind of movies do you like? Well, I really love French New Wave, cinema de look, Italian neorealism.
Yeah,
you know,
none the left of these, bank directors.
None of these things are actually that complicated, but they sound really impressive. So, especially French New Wave is the huge buzzword. I feel like, I mean, we just reviewed a couple movies that were in the movement, but it's funny because it started as a movement that was like anti-establishment, and now it's kind of like the thing that young filmmakers look to be like, this is how I want to ground my movie. So it's not really revolutionary anymore, but at the time it was.
Now it's the standard, yeah.
Yeah.
Now it's what film schools show.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So even revolutions just become average, everyday establishment pieces. So don't try too hard to be different. That's the main.
Conform.
That's what you're going to have to conform at some point. I mean, how are you? Yeah.
Do you want a good credit score?
Imagine a filmmaker who's like, He tries so hard to be different that he never even shows his movie to anyone, because that would be like
that's conforming a David Lynch thing to do.
Yeah. That's conforming to the here. You have to like steal it or something.
David Lynch might be our director of the year.
Yeah, certainly the most referenced guy on the. How does this movie relate to David Lynch? We have to find a way to shoehorn that in.
I don't know.
I don't think there's really that much that you can do with nothing. It. Yeah. David Lynch is not too sci-fi oriented, really.
A David Lynch.
I mean, it kind of is, but it's like in a much different.
A David Lynch Star Wars film?
No.
Okay.
No. Okay. That's way too commercial. He's done with the studios.
I was
other than Showtime, apparently.
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. What was the one that I said a David Lynch? What did I tell you?
Oh, I can't. It's alright.
It doesn't matter. But I've always been thinking of different things that we could put David Lynch on. That would be really cool.
We need to become his agents.
Yeah.
He's looking for one, I hear.
He's already completed his masterpiece, so he's good.
Yeah, he's good.
Anywho, have you ever seen any David Lynch films?
Name a few for me.
Let's see. The big ones are Eraserhead, Blue Velvet, Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much.
Man.
Yeah.
Straight story.
Eraserhead rings a bell. I don't know.
That's his first film.
I'm guessing like
you'd remember
not.
It if you'd watched it, because it's bizarre.
Okay.
No, David Lynch is the most postmodern as a director can get.
Okay.
I mean, there's like some negatives to his influence, but also it's like, I love him so much because it's like so weird and fun.
Yeah.
He creates fun worlds. So,
okay.
Yeah. All right. But anyway, we try to relate him to most of the films that we do. Now, I wanted to ask real quick, I know we're running out of time here soon, but... I get cringed whenever two people meet and then by the end of the film they're saying I love you and kissing.
Yeah.
And that's such a cliche. That was probably the only part of the film that I actually hated. Yeah. And maybe we could talk about the cliche for a minute.
Well, my take on it is that with the medium of film, usually you only got an hour and a half to 2.5 hours to make a story. And people like romance. I don't know whether you like watching romance that much, but a lot of people do.
Ben,
so
make inferences.
So maybe it would be better over the course of like a television show to like really develop what like a more realistic version of a relationship. But then to be honest, like it's a lot more commonplace that people, you know,
it takes them 2 hours to like not know each other, and then by the end of the 2 hours they're kissing. So that's a pretty relatable experience.
Love at first sight. I mean,
to a lot of people, maybe that's probably not the best way to develop.
I just hate that he got like he kissed her at the beginning without like she didn't even know.
Okay, see that's the
and then like he gets the girl an hour later.
Yeah, in the end they're rolling around in the nuclear lab.
Yeah, that's sort of the sleaziness.
Give him
of
five more minutes.
They're not ready.
You did the hand motions. Yeah. You're at the movie vault set, aka Ben's apartment.
That's right. Yeah, I hear where you're coming from. I think for me, what kind of allows me to diffuse the suspension of disbelief there is that I think it's more relatable for a friendship relationship to develop over time. And
how long did you date your current wife? I didn't mean current wife. I mean like your wife currently.
Unlike Luc Besson, I'm not on my fourth wife. I'm on my first.
Your wife is wonderful.
Yes.
How long were you with her before you married her?
So this is going to sound very calculated when I say it in hindsight. We dated for 4 months. We were engaged for 4 months. No. Sorry. We dated for 4 months. I knew that I wanted to marry her for 4 months, and it took me 4 months to make the ring.
Made it.
Yep. Wow. And then we were engaged for 4 months, and then we got married. Okay. It just kind of worked out that way.
Okay.
How long did you know her before you started dating?
We knew each other and knew of each other for a couple few years, but didn't know each other very well.
Okay. So there had been like some space for a relationship to form, but it was still not really.
I wouldn't say a relationship. We saw each other. We had mutual friends.
Gotcha. And then
leading up to dating, we spent time together at a mutual friend's house kind of consistently.
Gotcha.
Over time. And we had like encounters, like she came and helped pick grapes in my dad's vineyard. And so there was like that, you know, kind of sparks of romance.
Did you ever cuddle up with her and show her a Russian movie?
We actually, I'm pretty sure the first time that we watched Fifth Element together was on that old laptop.
Awesome.
On the Russian encoded DVD.
Awesome. Yeah. And now you guys have two wonderful and very extremely smart children.
Hey, there you go.
Yep. Leading, I remember your daughter, I've known your daughter since she was very little. And she was, when I first met her, she was like reading Little House on the Prairie. And how old was she like? When she first read that?
Let's see. She was seven, maybe?
Yeah.
Six or seven?
I think it was six. I was like very impressed. And she's, and your son's very smart as well. So, yeah. Hopefully it's from you guys. I mean, it's obviously from you guys, but I mean,
well,
got the right combination.
God's giftings, but yeah.
Right combination of genes. But yeah, I'll give the credit to God rather than science, I guess. So they're one in the same.
Yeah. Anyway. All right. Should we do some movie highlights?
Yes. Maybe Ian, this would be cool for you to start.
Okay.
You know, we usually do like the last week for us, but if you want to just go like any notable movies you've watched in the last like couple months, because I don't know how often you watch movies.
Yeah. So I don't watch very many movies. And so, so Cass and I will watch occasional movies. So in the last couple few months, I think I only got two movies that I can even mention, but I would say both of them are good. And so I watched, for the first time, I watched Interstellar.
Okay.
When I was on a business trip. And I enjoyed it. I thought it was a good movie. Obviously I don't resonate with the very obvious humanism theme to the movie,
mm-hmm.
but I really appreciated how kind of the slow reveal of this force that was interacting on the little girl's room that's new enough. I won't do the spoiler, but actually it's probably not that new. I take that back, but it was new to me. So I enjoyed that. And then the other movie that we watched recently was Royal Tenenbaums. I'm a big Wes Anderson fan.
Love that. Yes.
And Royal Tenenbaums is definitely my top five movie list. If you guys told me you didn't want to do Fifth Element, then the next movie on the list that I would want to review would be The Royal Tenenbaums.
We'll have to do that with you next.
Yeah, because actually, I've seen a lot of Wes Anderson movies, but Royal Tenenbaums is one that I have not seen yet. What? So.
Yeah. I don't know what my favorite one of his is. I really, really loved... oh, man, what's the... Rushmore?
Oh, yeah, Rushmore. Oh,
see, I haven't... I'm trying to think...
Rushmore is one of the earlier ones.
I love that.
It's different. Like his second...
It's feature. More like spunky style of... It's like, yeah, Wes Anderson...
It's before he got into all of the... like, miniatures and stuff.
Yeah.
Like,
before he got clean. That's what I say. It was before his detox. But not literally, of course. But
yeah.
Yeah, it's like Wes Anderson with a punch, and I love
it. I've also seen... have you seen Bottle Rocket? That's like his first.
That's his first? No. Yeah.
And that movie is... It's maybe like a little bit more raw or like rough around the edges, but I still thought it was pretty good.
Yeah.
So. Oh, wait. Is Rushmore where he falls in love with his teacher?
Yes.
Okay, so I've seen Rushmore. I haven't seen Bottle Rocket. I think Bottle Rocket, and then the most recent one, Atomic City. Those are the only Wes Anderson movies that I
haven't seen. Oh, yeah, yeah. I haven't seen the new
Asteroid
movie.
City.
Asteroid City. That's right. Excuse me.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah. Yeah, okay, we'll have to do Wes Anderson. We've only done the Grand Budapest Hotel in here.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good one. I like
that.
At
one point, that was my favorite movie.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good one.
I'm a big Wes Anderson guy. Fantastic Mr. Fox is fantastic.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And the only movie I've seen recently was The Truman Show.
Oh.
Awesome.
Was it a rewatch or a first time?
Rewatch, but I mean, I haven't seen it in a long time. I've never really
analyzed or thought about it. I love The Truman Show.
I think it's a great movie. It was so much more interesting than I remembered it as. And watching it the second time, you start noticing, you know, the mystery at the beginning, right in the first scene when the camera falls. I was rewatching it with some boys that I was babysitting, and they loved it as well. And they didn't understand it like I did, so I was trying to mansplain it to them the whole time. And it was fun. Right. I love doing that.
Right. Yesterday in class, I watched the film version of The Grapes of Wrath. Which is John Ford movie from 1940, mm-hmm. starring Henry Fonda. I didn't think it was that great, and I don't think my professor thought it was that great either. Yeah. He was just making us watch it. It's very like in that era. It was like,
plus it's tough because that was my The Grapes of Wrath was my favorite book for a period of time.
Really?
I'm a big Steinbeck fan, so I think making a movie particularly in that era would be pretty.
I need to actually read it. I was supposed to read The Grapes of Wrath for the class, but I never even really attempted to start reading it because, well, just having to read a book in 2 weeks and being forced to read it is not like the best context to read a book. So hopefully I'll go back and I think I have East of Eden and Of Mice and Men at my house. I'll have to
dive into those books. You should also read The Winter of Our Discontent.
Okay. Yeah. I'll have to go through a Steinbeck phase I always say I'm
going to send it to the group chat so I don't forget.
Okay.
Re-up my reading. Maybe that will actually happen after I graduate.
Yeah. Ben has so many plans. Like, I'll do this right after I graduate and it'll all work out. It's all going
to
work out.
What I need to do is rest.
Yeah.
Well, I can't.
You don't need to rest.
No, I can't rest. I have to study for my boards.
No, you got
to
work. You got to work hard. Yeah. No rest for you. No rest for the wicked.
That's true. We got to scale up the movie vault, so I got my work cut out for me.
We're double timing you, but we're not increasing your pay.
All right, Ian. I know you're getting to where you have to leave, so I appreciate you coming this early morning and doing this. This is a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, we'll have you on again. All jokes aside from the earlier part, we're really thankful to have you on the movie vault. And it's been a fun time. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the movie vault, we always close the vault, which means because we developed this thing where Zach and I are in the vault. We live here. There's lots of movies. And so the visitors, they come in, they open the vault door, they come in, visit with us, and then they leave. You have to close the vault. You can use whatever sound effect comes to your head in order to do that. So would you close the vault?
You got it. Well, before I close the vault, I'll just say thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it as well. It was a lot of fun. And so now I'm going to disengage the... okay, I'm reaching too far. So I'll just I'll do the click, click.
Perfect. Sweet.